Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program titled African Migrants in Post-Soviet Moscow, Adaptation in the Time of Radical Socio-Political Transformations. Our speaker is Dr. Dmitry Bondarenko, Deputy Director of the Africa Institute in Moscow. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, African American Studies Program Director Allison Blakely.
Our speaker this evening is Dr. Dmitry Bondarenko, an anthropologist and historian, and he's a native of Moscow, holds an MA in World History, Anthropology, and English from Moscow University, and a PhD and Doctor of Sciences in World History and Anthropology from the Russian Academy of Sciences. Dr. Bondarenko is Vice Director for Research of the Institute for African Studies of the Russian Academy of Sciences, and a full professor with the Center of Social Anthropology of the Russian State University for the Humanities in Moscow. He's been a visiting scholar with the Program of African Studies of Northwestern University at the Max Planck Institute of History in Göttingen in Germany, as well as at La Maison de Sciences de l'Homme, that is the International Center for the Science of Man, located in Paris. Dr. Bondarenko is a co-founder and co-editor of the international journal Social Evolution and History. His major research interests are anthropological theory, social cultural transformations, and intercultural interactions in the contemporary world. That's including ethnic, racial, and religious aspects, with a special focus on Africa and the peoples of African descent worldwide, and on political anthropology and the culture and history of Africa south of the Sahara. His current project deals with the mutual perceptions and attitudes of African Americans and recent African migrants to the U.S. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Bondarenko.
Well, thank you very much indeed, and actually I hope not to disappoint you well with my talk, because your applause is something what you are doing in advance of my talk, and this embarrasses me, you know. Well, first of all, I should like to express my sincere gratitude to Allison and to Professor Hall Weaver, due to whose effort and to whose kindness, I am here right now. As far as it's my really great honor and privilege to give this lecture, talk, whatever, at this very well-known, renowned university. And, a couple more preliminary, preliminary points. The first one is that to that nice introduction, I shall add that I used to do field work in several African countries, like Nigeria, Tanzania mainly, and also, in Benin, Zambia, Rwanda, and, currently, really, I'm doing research in this country, into the relations of relations between Africans and African Americans. In order, it's a sort of a combination of my major interests in Africa on the one hand, and in this country, in which I'm really very interested. As far as I worked as a visiting scholar for an American university many years ago, and so I come to this country repeatedly. So this is one point. And another point is, of course, that I have to ask you to excuse me for my English, which is so far from being perfect, but actually this is the only English I have, you know. I hope to be at least more or less understandable. And so, of course, what you see here is not Moscow. You can understand it easily. It's Accra, the capital of Ghana. The picture was taken about a year ago. The gentleman on the forefront. Yeah, well, is that time a candidate for presidency, and now the president of the country. He won, in the first round, John Mahama, who is a Soviet graduate. So he took his PhD program in Moscow, you know, in the early 80s, in the early and mid 80s. So, and actually, Africans constitute a rather small minority among the migrants to Russia. It appears that their numbers, as well as their impact on society at large, will probably never be comparable to those of migrants from former Soviet republics or even from some other countries like China or Vietnam. At the same time, it is evident that the inflow of Africans to Russia is growing, and they are becoming more noticeable in the Russian ethnocultural landscape, and yet there is still only a handful of studies on Africans in post-Soviet Russia. It would be difficult to understand how African migrants can and try to adapt in Moscow of the 2000s without acknowledging that certain historical particulars of Russian society pose specific challenges to them. For one thing, Russia does not have as long-lasting, diversified, and contradictory a history of interaction with Africans as do most West European nations, whose historical involvements have resulted in the firm establishment of diaspora communities and the elaboration of at least some basic principles of the receiving society's attitudes to and their state's policies toward the newcomers. In addition, the closed nature of Russian society in still recent Soviet times and the difficulties of the transitional period reforms complicate the matter even more. The national mass media have also played a negative part. Until the late 1980s, the image of Africans they spread was generally always positive, as a people struggling against world imperialism and economic backwardness. But since the time of Gorbachev's perestroika, Africans have often been represented as symbols of hopeless savagery and stupidity. It has also been implied and even openly stated that by helping African countries, the communist regime had just been wasting money instead of making friends with the, what was called civilized world, that is the West, and raising living standards of Soviet citizens. Beninois, who spent in Russia 13 years from the late 1980s till early 2000s, says in an interview to us, Russia does not know Africa, or pretends it does not know, because the image of Africa in Russia is as follows: a poor continent where people live primitively in the forest, eat coconuts and bananas, and where all have AIDS. Today, this attitude to Africa and its inhabitants, which unfortunately is still supported by certain voices in the mass media, remains alive in the consciousness of a significant portion of the Russian population. This position manifests itself, for example, in hundreds of angry comments on the internet on every official's declaration that Russia will help African countries, most often write off part of their debts. Another very commonly held view of Africa and Africans portrays them as exotic and as objects of curiosity. It is not by chance that in recent years Africa has become a popular destination for wealthy Russian tourists. For those sharing this view, Africa is associated with heat, bananas, hippopotamuses, and so forth. There is no aggression in this perception, but it does reflect the fact that people are not ready to accept Africans' presence in Russian city streets as an everyday reality. So this is a theater poster. The ransom of Red Chief after O. Henry. And what is written on it, selling of refreshments, chewing gum, and other chicken feet just during the performance by a real Negro. Know that there are no black... Those who are Russian readers can read it themselves here. So, by the way, note that there are no black characters in the famous O. Henry's story. So, the producer needed the real Negro to make the juvenile performance more African flavor. More American flavor, as far as black people are perceived both as exotic in themselves, as a part of the African exotics, and as a typical feature of the USA
One of those which make America a country completely different from Russia. This oversimplified and one-sided image of Africa and Africans is now actively exploited by both film producers, TV soap, opera, and sitcom directors, and advertisers. So, some more pictures. This is a cinema poster. Text on the side stand. Equator and Ulyana Shilkina's military comedy. And text on the central stand, you see. We will teach all to love Africa. What is a clear allusion to the phrase Russian officers and corporals ostensibly like to repeat to private rookies while drilling them. I will teach you to love motherland. You know. So, for instance, Africans are often portrayed on the billboards of tanning salons. Advertisement in subway. I am going to a sun deck, to sunbathe. These four are with me. So, on the internet, one can easily find offers promoting, I'm quoting, real African show programs for corporate parties, New Year celebrations, and weddings. The most recent word of fashion is to invite a black Father Frost, Russian Santa Claus, to entertain a kid on New Year, with which, not with Christmas, this character has been associated since Soviet times. Our study also testifies to the fact that young Russians, even their most educated and informed part, such as Moscow University students, have very little knowledge, even at the basic level, about African culture, ethnography, history, geography, politics, and so on. This can be viewed as a symptom of the general unsatisfactory situation with school education in present-day Russia, to what I can testify personally as a father of a school student, you know, really, it's incredible. So, indeed, the deficit of information leads to simplification and corruption of the image of Africa and Africans in Russia. Just by scarcity of real information about Africa and her peoples, the majority of our Moscow African interlocutors explain some young Russians' anti-African actions. In the meantime, it is worth noting that since recent time, African art and photo exhibitions have become not so rare events in Moscow cultural life, and many young people can be seen in the exhibition halls on these occasions. It also goes without saying that the youth forms the overwhelming majority in concert halls when an African group, professional coming from abroad, or semi-professional formed by Africans living in Russia, is giving a concert. Schools of African drumming, run mostly by native Russians who attract Africans to teaching, are becoming more and more popular among young Muscovites. However, for example, in survey in 2008, only 36% of almost 100 interviewed Moscow University students turned out able to name at least five sub-Saharan states, while 26% could not recall even one. It became clear in the course of conversations that some of them were confused by the very expression Africa south of the Sahara. Being asked to name prominent Africans they know, not so few students recalled African-American jazzmen, Pelé, Naomi Campbell, some other black but not African well-known people, and 57% could not name anybody at all. Naomi Campbell was mentioned by 37% of the respondents, while the most often recalled real Africans, Nelson Mandela and Patrice Lumumba, in only 14% and 11% respectively. 47% believe that not European but African languages are official in the majority of post-colonial African states, and so on and so forth. As in any contemporary society, there are racists in Russia, both active and passive, implicit. It is an erroneous, though widespread in Russia, view that there were no racists in the Soviet Union and that they appeared in the turbulent post-Soviet society of the 1990s, actually from nowhere. Yet, nothing can come out from nowhere, and at least in the time when popular belief in communist ideology was decaying, in the 1970s and the 80s, there really were people, probably less numerous than nowadays, who, despite the propaganda, disliked racial others, Africans in particular. However, what is important to realize is that they had no possibilities to act or even express their views openly. The Soviet authorities were still able to suppress all what did not correspond to the official ideology, either good or bad. In any case today, Due to the national and international media, many people in the world, including Africa, are very well aware of drastic acts of racism that took place in different Russian cities not so long ago. In particular, the awareness of them prevents some Africans from going to Russia for getting education, and in general, they damage seriously the image of Russia in Africa and worldwide. Naturally, social and political cataclysms always provoke aggravation of the interest to the other, and the Russian society, one of the most turbulent at the turn of the millennia, has revealed this interest in a variety of forms, including really painful. Yet our research leads us to agree with a colleague, Yelena Kharitonova, who argued that, I quote, in general, Moscow Africans are assessed by Moscow Russians without steady negative associations and do not have the status of enemy in the Muscovites' mass consciousness. However, if this is really so, why are racists so visible in present-day Russia? This problem, as I see it, has two dimensions. The first of these is the attitude of Russian society at large to racists. Compared with many societies in the West, in Russia there are far fewer non-racist citizens who would be ready to take overt action against racists and to declare openly and loudly that they are against racism and that the Russian nation is not racist. This is a reflection of contemporary Russian society's general condition. There is still no well-developed civil society in which, at least ideally, everyone regards all that happens in society as being potentially everyone's business. Hence, there is a tendency to simply shift complete responsibility for the course of events to the state. The second dimension is the state's legal struggle against racial as well as ethnic and religious extremism. Although suppression of extremism has been declared an important goal of the state, the legal basis for this struggle strengthened, and a number of important criminal cases have been brought to court. The fact that those prosecuted often receive only mild sentences, and that right-wing extremist organizations continue in their activities quite openly, demonstrates that problems in this sphere still persist. Russian immigration policy is also far from being clear and precise. The current immigration legislation is more liberal than in Soviet times, when the country was actually closed to potential migrants of any sort, with the exception of a handful of politically motivated and engaged candidates. But it is still very difficult for a foreigner to gain permanent residence or citizen status. The easiest way to do so is the same as it was in the USSR, to marry a citizen of the country. Our interlocutors from the national human rights organizations have told us that very few of those seeking refugee status, including Africans, are granted it. All in all, the Russian migration laws remain generally rather vague and hence leave much room for arbitrary interpretations and corruption in their practical application. This is particularly due to the continuing discussion, both in the public sphere and various governmental circles, of whether migrants are beneficial for Russia and of what desirable ethnic, cultural, and educational professional priorities should be introduced as selection criteria for accepting them. Opinions vary from the idea of only welcoming ethnic Russians, especially from the former Soviet republics, to that of opening the doors to the country as widely as possible. Because of the huge influx of migrants from former Soviet republics, the dominant public mood today is that immigration legislation should be tightened. It is certainly the case that there is no strategic vision of migration as a positive event in Russia up to now. At the same time, the situation regarding migrants from Africa has changed radically with the breakup of the Soviet Union. Until the early 1990s, almost all the Africans residing in the country had been university and college students, that is, non-permanent residents, spread rather evenly among numerous education centers all over the USSR, except for parts of Siberia and the Far East. Today, the overwhelming majority of Africans in Russia are concentrated in a limited number of large cities, Moscow first and foremost. The number of African students coming to Russia has decreased considerably, mainly due to the cutting of state quotas for the education, for free education, and the introduction of tuition fees that are too high for many of the prospective students. In the meantime, the raising of the Iron Curtain and the collapse of the USSR made it easier for foreigners to get entry visas, which has led to many migrants of other kinds coming into the country. However, in the 2000s, the visa regime has become tougher and the efforts to maintain it more effective than in the 1990s. At present, some Africans residing in Moscow are refugees from the sites of current or recent violent conflicts, Ethiopia, Somalia, Rwanda, the DRC, Cote d'Ivoire, and so on, while most are economic migrants from all over the continent. Today, the number of Africans in Moscow can be estimated very roughly at about 10,000, including 1,000 students, out of a total of approximately 40,000 African residents of the Russian Federation. Research has shown that many Africans experience difficulties in adapting to life in Moscow. Insufficient education background and poor Russian language skills and lifestyle knowledge, differences in climate, very limited financial possibilities, with little hope for any kind of support by the home country's official representatives, and few, if any, Russian friends, all these issues complicate matters for many, if not most, present-day newcomers. Coming to Russia with families alleviates, to some extent, the migrants' psychological problems, but it makes the problem of earning money even more acute for them. Not all Africans have legal residency or work permits, and it is very difficult to get them, even for those of them who have graduated from Russian universities, sometimes including those who have married Russian citizens. According to official statistics, in 2011, only 356 migrants from sub-Saharan African states were granted work permits all over the Russian Federation, including 113 Nigerians and 91 South Africans. Moreover, African migrants usually complain that it is rather difficult to find a better job even for those of them who speak fluent Russian and enjoy a permanent legal status. Again, in 2011, only 76 natives of sub-Saharan African countries were granted permanent residence permits, and just 30 obtained full citizenship. Africans tell stories like this. When I was seeking a job, I used to call and say, "Hello, I want to work for your company." Then I was asked if I am native Russian, and then they answered, "Sorry, we hire only Russians." At the same time, Moscow, now a typical neoliberal metropolis, offers plenty of low-paying jobs that tend to be taken by migrants as well as poor and unskilled workers from different parts of the Russian Federation and Muscovites from underprivileged social categories. For example, one can see Africans distributing advertisement leaflets and standing as sandwich people at subway station entrances. So this is a typical picture, you see. Typically, this work is fulfilled not by immigrants, but by Russian natives from financially disadvantaged social categories, mainly students and pensioners. Africans seem to be the only migrants to penetrate into this sphere of activities. One can also see Africans selling cheap clothes, footwear, utensils, and so forth in numerous manufactured goods markets, where they work side by side with Russians, Ukrainians, people from the Caucasus, East and Southeast Asia, and others. Some Africans work on construction sites or are engaged in cleaning offices and sweeping streets and yards. Typically, most of their fellow workers in these sectors are from Central Asia, in sweeping and cleaning, and from Turkey, Moldova, Ukraine, Serbia, and again Central Asia, in construction. The situation can be less uncomfortable for students who, as a rule, have residence permits, are provided with housing at university dorms, study Russian with teachers during the first year of their stay in the country, and can seek for support from their country's embassies. However, their adaptation to life in Moscow does not usually proceed smoothly either. Many of them also have to look for a job, usually in the same sectors as African non-students, even though their foreign student status does not allow them to work. Be that as it may, after coming to Moscow, most migrants do manage to improve their living standards in comparison to those they were accustomed to in their home countries, which are often very low indeed. Nevertheless, contrary to the majority of African migrants to the West, only few of them turn out able to earn enough to send remittances home to support their remaining their relatives. This is one of the reasons why many Africans that arrive in Russia would probably say that they hope to go to Western Europe or North America one day. Our respondent, a Cameroonian residing in Russia for over 10 years by the time of interview, said about such migrants, "I call them swindlers. About 90% of Africans that come to Russia are of this sort. Those who arrive here and then begin to look for a way to go further." Other Africans would say that they hope to return to their home countries sooner or later. However, some of these people are eager to recognize honestly that in most cases their ideas of going to the West or return home is nothing more than a psychological trick they are playing on themselves. Their dreams of enjoying a sweeter life in a third country or going home in the future help them cope with hardships here and now. It can be safely argued that today it is more difficult for people coming from Africa to adapt to life in Moscow and Russia in general than it was in the Soviet times. The validity of this generalization becomes especially evident when one compares the situation of the students before and after the end of communist rule. In the Soviet Union, the systematic facilitation of foreign students' adaptation to life there was thought out at the state level with the participation of scholars and special departments in universities to care of foreign students in every way. Their Soviet fellow students, partly at the encouragement of university authorities and partly because it was a rare opportunity for them to communicate with foreigners, usually treated the Africans, whom they saw as victims of imperialism and as fighters for a better life, with sincere interest and affection, eagerly including them in their company. Today, foreign students most often encounter a very formal attitude on the part of the university authorities, which are no longer bound by such strict state regulations and control. No special measures for their socialization are taken, and on campuses, Russian and African students form two distinct communities, each living for itself. In those segments of the mass media sympathetic to their plight, Africans are represented most often as victims of difficult circumstances that accompany their establishment in Russia, including not only such natural problems as drastically different climate, language, and so forth, but also the issues caused by imperfections in the national migration legislation, manifestations of racism, and so on. Although these and many other problems do exist, there is nevertheless another, smaller but still distinctive and significant segment of the African migrant population in Russia, which is formed of very different people whose fortunes contrast with the representation of Africans as passive victims in the receiving society. These are Africans who have found pathways toward social recognition and success in a Russian megacity and eventually managed to establish a worthy, even prestigious place for themselves in society. Almost all these people are Soviet or Russian university alumni, have lived in Russia for at least 20 years or so, and have obtained Russian citizenship, mainly through marriage, speak fluent Russian, know the Russian lifestyle very well, enjoy support from Russian family members and respect in their home countries, have native Russians as close friends, happy to see their children being very well integrated into Moscow city life, and are always welcome in their motherland's embassies in Moscow, and sometimes even become their native country's official representatives in Russia. They are journalists, university teachers, medical doctors, translators, and so on, even show business people, musicians, singers, dancers, DJs, or VJs. So this is an advertisement again in Subway. What is it? You see black to white, yeah, right, in English. Because English today is regarded as something prestigious in Russia, you know. If you know a couple of English words, you know, you are. And if you can speak English, you know, it's great. So what is written, so black to white. And then morning with black pepper. Black to white is an interactive entertainment portal. One of the three VJs is the most dark-skinned VJ in Russia, the witty Afro-Muscovite M.S. Simon. Know that in contemporary Russian youth slang, pepper stands for guy or body. So that's it. So the most well-known among these people is the Cameroonian singer, MC and DJ, ex-Russian university student Pierre Narcisse. Here he is with his Russian wife and their daughter. So many Africans are economists, managers, and other professionals involved in or related to different kinds of business. Some are successful middle-class entrepreneurs. These Africans have consciously linked their lives to Russia and prefer to establish and strengthen their positions in Russian society by promoting cooperation with Russian social peers rather than with compatriots if they are with low social status, those who might be referred to as common migrants. So, to sum up, Since the early 1990s, the social composition of Africans in Russia has changed greatly and has become more heterogeneous, while at the same time, in terms of geography, African migrants are now present as a perceivable minority in fewer cities and regions. If we approach the diaspora community not simply as the offspring of an area who have spread to many lands or a dispersed group living outside the homeland, but as a network community that serves as a means of both more successful establishment in the receiving society and of pre-migration identity support, and due to numerous and various visible and invisible connections among its members, forms a distributed social unit without a single shared fixed territory, something like status and statu, within a wider society, we have to argue that the process of diaspora formation among Africans in Russia is developing slowly. Many people remain completely excluded from it, since their social ties are limited to a narrow circle of their immediate acquaintances. Most often, this is a consequence of their objective circumstances, such as unofficial migrants' necessary clandestinity, but sometimes it is due to an individual's own wishes. However, some conscious attempts to unite at least some groups of migrants have been made, characteristically, not by the neediest, but vice versa, by some of the most well-off and integrated African Russians in the receiving society. This is especially true of the official that is registered, Russian Migrants Federation, which first Congress was held in 2008 in the grandiose President Hotel with the Russian Parliament members as distinguished guests. So, and with you see who's portrait is there also. So the Federation appeared on the initiative of and is dominated by successful businessmen, mainly of South Asian origin, and includes migrants from outside the former Soviet Union. Though the Malian businessman Sumare Demba is the Federation vice president, the Africans' influence in it is less than that of Asians or Latin Americans. The Federation president, the Indian Mujumder Amin, explained it to us by the fact that there are fewer successful wealthy business people among Africans than among migrants from other continents, so they can invest less in the Federation's activities. As a rule, however, the migrants' organizations take the shape of informal, unregistered clubs and societies which aim not only to provide their members with support and recreation in the native cultural milieu, but also to facilitate their business and social success in Russia. In their activities, such organizations involve respectable Africans almost exclusively. Generally, these informal voluntary associations are based on personal relations which provide group solidarity. Such associations, as well as compatriots' support in general in various forms, play a positive role in the process of Africans' integration into Russian society. I quote, "We all know cell phone numbers of each other, know when one has a birthday. Sometimes we get together and visit one of us to talk about current news," a member of a Cameroonian fellow migrants association told us. In fact, any organizational work demands time and money that African migrants with low social status and income cannot afford to spend freely beyond the necessity of having legal status in the country in order to have the right to register an official organization. Migrants of this other category, common migrants, have their own forms and ways of finding each other in Moscow's megacity jungle. The social distance between these two segments of the African population in Russia is therefore quite large, and their spheres of interaction are limited. Well-integrated, respectable Africans even tend to separate themselves from other migrants. In talks with each other or with us, they often refer to those people as they, avoiding associating themselves with the common migrants, including compatriots, even though many of them told us they had used to help their poor compatriots on occasion whenever they could. Nigerians are definitely most advanced on the pathway of diaspora building, not only in Russia but in other post-Soviet states too. Although permanent migrants from some other African countries, particularly the Cameroonians, are planning to make their associations official, at the moment the Nigerian Community Russia, with branches in Moscow and St. Petersburg, and founded later the Nigerians in Diaspora Organization Russia, a chapter of the Nigerians in Diaspora Organization Europe, in its turn the European arm of a global network of Nigerians in Diaspora, with headquarters in London. So these are the only officially registered associations of this kind in Russia, with their elected administrative bodies, official websites, and pages on Facebook, strong ties with the Nigerian embassy in Moscow and with compatriots in the home country and all over the world, and so forth. The Nigerian in diaspora organization Russia counts over 100 registered members. Typically for such organizations, no matter registered or not, in the words of its chairman, Dr. Bashir Obasekola, its members are largely non-students who are already accomplished in their professions but currently working or doing business in Russia. The focus of the organization is to mobilize Nigerian professionals and entrepreneurs living in Russia. On the contrary, the Nigerian community in Russia, which has more, about 200 members, is an organization for everyone. There is no particular focus on any group. Students, non-students, professionals, or artisans are all supposed to be involved. The relationship between the two organizations, the chairman of one of them said, is very cordial, since most of the members of NIDO Russia are also activists of the other one. So, Dr. Basikola himself was the president of the Nigerian community Russia for 8 years before becoming the chairman of the Nigerians in Diaspora Organization Russia. Besides registered members, both organizations have sympathizers among Nigerians residing in Russia who yet have doubts in the profitability of official joining any of them due to different reasons. In particular, as one of our interlocutors said, several years ago, many Nigerians were afraid of identifying themselves as a union nation. We did not trust each other. It was caused by the ethno-religious and social-political situation in Nigeria. Even abroad, it is hard for us Nigerians to realize ourselves as united nations from one country with common aim. In the USSR, there was an invisible demarcation line between foreigners and common Soviet people. This distinction was not enshrined in law, but it could be clearly seen in the special practices of the Soviet-style urban planning, which was very functional in its nature. The implication was that foreign students, who, let us remind, in those days formed the vast majority among African residents, should spend most of their lives in dormitories and in the remote areas of the city, while their contact with Soviet people was to be kept to the unavoidable minimum for ideological reasons. Today, both state ideology and social composition of African migrants are different. While historically no ethnic, with the numerical domination of non-Russian inhabitants, neighborhoods have formed in Moscow. In particular, no African neighborhood exists, and though there seems to be a trend to African common migrants' concentration in the poorest and socially lowest southeastern and eastern outskirts and suburbs of the city, while Moscow's southwestern outskirts, where the famous International People's Friendship University of Russia, known worldwide as Lumumba University, is situated, remains the center of attraction for African students and graduates. Africans are scattered all over the city and the city region. So churches and mosques situated in different parts of Moscow are examples of another type of institution around which a significant number of African migrants collect, although far from all attend a church or a mosque regularly, especially among those more socially established and financially well-off who have less need of the moral or practical support a religion institution can provide. African Orthodox Christians, Ethiopians, as well as Muslims, may visit the same churches or mosques attended by native Russian citizens of other ethnic origins and cultural traditions, and should they choose to do so, may try to establish informal relations with the with the respective religious community or parish members. At the same time, there also are several Catholic, Lutheran, and Anglican churches in Moscow, as well as quite a number of churches of new Protestant congregations, including African, that is created and led by African preachers, which are active in Russia. The social background of their parishes is mixed and includes many individuals who are not well established in Russian society in either practical or psychological terms. The role played by such churches in the integration of the Africans is ambivalent. On the one hand, as is the case elsewhere, these churches help African migrants in their lives in Russia by giving them consolation and support, providing them with feeling of security and stability, and creating an atmosphere in which they can express and reproduce the values of their native cultures, and thereby maintain their cultural identities. On the other hand, affiliation with these churches raises an additional barrier on the migrants' way to integration in the cultural milieu of the receiving country, and so promotes their parishioners' continued seclusion from wider Russian society. Not by chance are they often called foreign churches in the media and by the public. These churches have no roots in mainstream Russian culture and are perceived by the overwhelming majority of the country's native citizens as completely alien. In the light of their more politicized than truly religious minds, these churches are seen as the enemy's agents in the eternal and irresolvable opposition between Russia, inseparable from Orthodox Christianity, and the West, symbolized by Catholicism and Protestantism. Finally, there are several nightclubs, cafes, and restaurants in Moscow in which Africans, especially the young, like to meet. Naturally, they are more and less respectable among these eateries. Typical regular visitors of some of them are African students and migrants with a modest but stable and at least more or less legal income. The most popular cafe of this sort is Avenue, situated on the periphery of the city, on campus of the International People's Friendship University of Russia, and run by this university old graduate from Ethiopia and his Russian wife. So this small cafe is democratic in terms of prices and less well known among Russians than among Africans, who use it as a meeting place, somewhere to socialize with each other and to immerse themselves in a familiar cultural atmosphere to express their identities freely. As the cafe's proprietor's Russian wife said, here is a place where no one will judge. In other words, Avenue gives Africans a sense of home and of belonging to a community, which becomes a lived experience of that particular locality. Besides, Avenue is also the place where the Ethiopian community holds meetings every Saturday. The lavish Addis Ababa restaurant in prestigious downtown, at present the only two Moscow eateries run by Africans, also Ethiopian graduates of Soviet and Russian universities, is visited mainly by Russians and Western expats. Only a handful of the most successful Moscow Africans are among its habitués. So this is that, you see, another, well, very lavish and prestigious restaurant. What is important to find out is the level at which Africans who have come to Russia from all over the continent yet tend to integrate. From the outside, for a Russian townie, they are and most probably will forever remain the Africans, that is a single African community. This homogenizing perception on the vast part of native Russians can to some extent stimulate strengthening of the ties between Africans of different ethnic and even national origins. Yet our analysis shows that the real situation is far from that envisioned by a typical Muscovite. Although Africans in Moscow usually have acquaintances among people from different African states, the basic level of their integration is with the culture and people of their country of origin and not with those of common ethnic or regional origins, whether within their country or within the African continent or with some other kind of social group. The answer to the question, are you divided by ethnic groups here in Moscow, of an Ethiopian respondent is characteristic in this respect. Here, no, not like in Ethiopia. As for pan-African sentiments, they may be present as a virtual frame for distinguishing us from them in the white cultural milieu. However, as a rule, these sentiments do not lead to the emergence of stable, nationally mixed, informal or formal groups, clubs or societies. This is especially true in cases where the European languages spoken in African migrants' home countries are different, although practically all our respondents declared that they were ready to offer informal help to any African from any state. This conclusion seems to be equally true for both social types of Africans in Russia, except sometimes in cases of an ongoing tension between ethnic groups in the migrants' home country. In these cases, if the mutual dislike is so strong that is irresistible even in another country, the representatives of conflicting groups may use the tactics of more or less strict mutual avoidance, even when living abroad in Moscow. On the other hand, if problems in interpersonal relations become grave and begin to threaten the tranquility of the whole national community, its most authoritative members try to pacify those quarreling by encouraging them to realize that though while in their home country they can divide themselves into groups according to ethnicity, while abroad they must feel that they are people of one nation and behave accordingly. During our research, we were repeatedly told about such situations by Ethiopians, Cameroonians, Nigerians. Therefore, SED is applicable not only to legal permanent and illegal migrants, but also to the African students, the official temporal migrants. In particular, there are several organizations of the students from Nigeria and Cameroon. It can happen that for some members of such unions, the ethnic origin really matters, but as the leader of a Cameroonian student association said, we try to stop them immediately. We tell them, there in the home country, you may divide, but we have come here, and here we are all together. Characteristically, the Pan-African Association of the International People's Friendship University of Russia, called Association of the People's Friendship University of Russia African Students, is designed as a federation of the separate African countries' student unions. Furthermore, it must be pointed out that the association is relatively new. It was organized in 1995, while the first national African student unions appeared immediately after the university's founding in 1960. As the association members openly admit, it was only the hardships of the 1990s in most of the African states and in Russia, which made foreign students' life in Russia extremely difficult, that pushed the university's African national student unions to integration. Thus, no single African diaspora community, in the sense of communities suggested by Cohen, which exists without any necessary links to a certain place or regular gatherings, is emerging in Russia. Though from the outside, these people are, and most probably will always be seen as the Africans, that is, as a single African community, what we can observe at present among Moscow Africans is in reality a rather weak trend toward the formation of internally heterogeneous national diaspora communities with a loose sense of their pan-African unity, a sense which exists mainly because, from the point of view of most native Russians, all these people are members of a single African community, and which may manifest itself mainly in cases of common emergency, such as the necessity of resisting racist attacks. The Nigerians are most advanced on this pathway, probably being followed by the Cameroonians and Ethiopians. To summarize, it is safe to predict a further increase in the number of African migrants in Russia, given that Russia remains an open-to-the-world state, while at the moment their infusion in Russian society faces difficulties explainable by the unpreparedness of many of them on the one hand, and by the incomplete readiness of the Russian state and society to accept them on the other hand. Well, it's about all. Thank you. Well, thank you very much.
Professor Petrenko will entertain questions. I have one, if no one else is eager to grab the mic. One is whether your estimate of the population of Africans in Russia as a whole includes illegal residents. And the second is whether you have a sense that what you've learned from your intensive study of Moscow is applicable to, let's say, St. Petersburg and other parts.
So as for the figures, actually no official statistics exists. These figures is something what I got from most often from Russian officials, from the Federal Migration Service like that, from the Ministry of Internal Affairs on the one hand, and on the other hand, this is how some African interlocutors, which seem to me most reasonable, estimate the number of Africans in the country. Usually, the figures Africans themselves provide are bigger than those officials provide. But in reality, I don't know if these figures exist. If they exist officially, they are not for public, So generally, this figure is to include all Africans. Because the official figure of African, the official number of Africans in Russia is
Well, if you include, you know, well, students, those who got, well, official residence permits, citizenship, and so forth, it will be, of course, much lower than 40,000, much lower. As for your second question, yes, I do believe that the situation in Moscow may have some specific features, you know, as far as it is the capital, you know, and the biggest city. It's actually the point of attraction for many people, well, from Russia herself, you know. But as for the life in megacities in general, well, of course, Moscow is the biggest city, but such cities as St. Petersburg, well, Nizhny Novgorod, Yekaterinburg, yeah, also big, very big cities, yeah. Well, the basic principles are just the same, are just the same. So I think that in general, yes, we can extrapolate, well, the situation in Moscow, well, on the situation with Africans in Russia in general, as far as I said it at the outset, well, I shall say maybe 90% of Africans residing in the country nowadays live in the biggest cities.
Well, I want to sincerely thank Professor Bodarenko for sharing with us an unusually revealing and inside glimpse at the situation of Africans in Russia.
Thank you very much indeed.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Dr. Dmitry Bondarenko, Deputy Director of the Africa Institute in Moscow. Dr. Bondarenko's lecture was titled African Migrants in Post-Soviet Moscow, Adaptation in the Time of Radical Socio-Political Transformations. It was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was African American Studies Program Director Allison Blakely. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.